Yes, I said, yes, you can have another glass of rum when it's off, and we cut it off, and we bandage it up, and that's the furthest back. And he called on Freddie Grubb a couple of years ago, and Freddie invited him up to his house, and Carol gave he and his wife tea. And so you were talking about the warmth between the RCN and the RCNVR. There's Freddie Grubb and this leading seaman, Fred Berry, and Berry coming down to see me. So there's, from what you said, there's my story. Who's the oldest man you knew?
Well, at this reunion the other night, two people stand out in my memory. They both come from the old Restigouche, which from the very early beginning of the war, when I was the first lieutenant and Nelson Lay was the skipper. One of them was Johnny Andrus. Now, Johnny Andrus was a VR officer from Toronto. Short, dark,
old.
Little thin on top now, and an absolute powerhouse of a guy. He was a gunnery specialist, the short course that he did have when he came to the Restigouche. But he was always full of fun, full of the, what I would call the power of command, which we understand so well. He was a commanding young officer. He had complete control of his gunnery department. He was red hot and he was fun. And I hadn't seen Johnny Andrus really since about 1943 or earlier than that. So here we're talking the 40 year plus. And it took me a split second the other night to when he came up, just as if we'd met each other after a pause of perhaps a week. And he just continued the conversation, more or less, when we had left, he had left the Restigouche, or I had left, I forget who left first. And it was just wonderful seeing old Johnny again, and suddenly that surge of realizing who this guy really was. This is Johnny Andrus, my old buddy of 45 years ago. And it was wonderful talking to him. Another one who was at the dinner and the ball at the Nova Scotian, was somebody I was looking forward to meeting a great deal. And that was Art Howard. Now, Art Howard is a signalman. He now lives out in Victoria. Yeah. You'll probably meet him out there.
Oh,
he's the one I had mentioned previously, that time when we were plowing through the Mediterranean at 32 knots or so, catching up with a troop convoy, and right in the middle of the night, three torpedoes dashing toward the ship, and he was the signalman of the watch, and I was up on watch just before turning in, knowing it would take 2 hours to catch the convoy, and these three phosphorescent jet streams were coming right for the after part of the ship, and I knew we were going to be torpedoed at any moment. All I could do is say, hard to starboard and bend my knee. And just before, you know that story, just before the three torpedoes hit the ship, I figured out who would be killed. Isn't it a pity that Davy Groose had just become engaged, and isn't it tough on the other officers who would be killed because they were sleeping aft? And while I was working all this out, probably in a half a second, the three torpedoes turned to starboard, jumped out of the water, and there were three porpoises. Well, it was Art Howard who was on the bridge with me. He watched all this in horror as it was about to unfold. And when it turned out to be a happy little frolic with some porpoises, Art Howard said to me in a rather high-pitched voice, he said, "Well, sir, who's going to go down and change their trousers first?" Well, that was Art Howard. But Art was, of course, famous also as one of the leaders of the radio program we had in the Restigouche, the Man in the Flat program. A guy with tremendous personality. And I'd been looking and looking and looking to see Art Howard in recent years. Like 40-plus years, he got his officer's commission. And I had a hunch. Somebody said they'd seen him. And I got up from my table at the banquet. I went out into the hall and got the records and searched through. We didn't have an alphabetical list. I looked through every damn table until
that, yeah.
I ran across the name of Art Howard. He was at table 51, and I came in, and we had a reunion. I'm telling you, it was a great moment for both of us. But there were dozens like that over the weekend. Yeah. It's wonderful.
Well, I think that's a good note on which to close, don't you? We've had it's despite what people say about those years, all in retrospect, how we could have done it better. Everybody did the best they could according to the training they had. And this week has shown us all that we really are a band of brothers, as Harry Porter said, and as you say.
Mm-hmm. Perhaps I could add another little postscript to all this. We all did it as we saw it and as God gave us the ability to do things. We all have different personalities and they react in different ways. Now, I think it's a good thing. It's a good thing that people like Mark Milner and others have written books on this. Mark, a young, brilliant student who has taken the record as he sees it. And he's analyzed the records and without any knowledge of the events himself. He was probably not even born when these things were going on. I'm sure he wasn't. But he has taken the record as it was and analyzed it. And we're big enough to take criticism. There's no doubt, referring to that awful period on the North Atlantic in late 42, when our losses were so high. We were relatively inexperienced with relatively bad equipment, but we should not be afraid to face up to the analysis of it and admit certain shortcomings. Now, this doesn't detract one iota from the success we did have eventually. When we finally got our equipment and got our ships and we were taking over the whole of the North Atlantic in 1944, 1945, we did a thoroughly good job at that time because we had the experience. The other thing we had, of course, was the aircraft. We were never able, up until early, middle of 43 or late 43, have enough aircraft to cover that gap between Newfoundland and Greenland.
Well, Black Pit, yeah.
Yeah, the Black Pit, and that's where they nailed SC-107 and the other convoys. But I have no hesitation whatsoever to read these accounts that are put out now by young students like Mark Milner and others, and they analyze it from a cold, critical point of view, and they see shortcomings that perhaps we did not see at that time. I'm not going to cry in my beer over that. We did the best we could with what we had, and we did pretty damn well. There's another aspect of the young historian now who has to go to the record to get his information. We, as Canadians, in all three services, were appallingly poor at the end of the war of putting things on paper. Perhaps we always felt we should leave it to somebody else. Take the record as it exists of the wartime commanders, Army. We don't have any real books from Canadian Army commanders of the Second World War. Guy Simmons, toward the end of his life, was urged by all his friends in all services to get on with it such a highly respected officer, not only by Canadians, but by the Allies as well. Lots of Canadians in all services felt that we should have a record by Guy Simmons. I think he started to do it, but his premature death overcame that effort. And now books on the Army are written by younger officers who participated. There's a very good one by Denny Whittaker just come out, which tells it as he sees it after very considerable research. But we don't have available books by the wartime commanders. This is perfectly true, of course, both the Air Force and the Navy. None of our Navy admirals wrote books, authoritative books, at the time of their experiences during the war, the way the British and the Americans did. And I think that's very sad. So what happens now? A couple of things happen. In retrospect, a few people have taken the trouble to write their story of it for reasons which you and I know, depending on the individual. I have been hoping to write a book myself for a long while, and you know that too, and you've encouraged me on this, but I don't see any formula. I've told you this before, it must be a little boring to you. I don't know. I don't want to write a book on how we won the war, Daddy. I don't want to write a book to say Debbie Pierce went to school when he was 6 years old and went to RMC when he was 16 and joined the Navy, etc. Mm. And what I did just as a chronological sequence of things. I would like to write a book, and I probably will in the long run, of the various experiences that I was privileged to share with the great and the not-so-great over a period of 35 years or more, and particularly in wartime. I'm a little lost on the formula for that. I would like it to be a sort of an adventure story to encourage young Canadian boys and girls to join the Navy, because I think it's a great experience. But we do lack a basic historical section of senior officers in all three services. Now, Hal, I'm going to make you blush on this yourself. I think you have done a fantastic job. Your personal determination to get people like myself and other admirals on tape of where we were and what we did and what we thought, and to give our opinions. I can't tell you how I admire the way you snuck up on me several months ago when you were in Halifax, and would I come in and see you and discuss things. And I was all prepared, perhaps in 2 or 3 weeks' time, to have a session with you somewhere else, and I found you'd nailed me down that day. And what did we do? We ended up doing 7.5 hours of tapes. And I'm so glad that you did that. And I then went on, as you know, and promised to give you another several hours on tape to finish my own experiences up until the end of the Second World War. Now, you have done this with great determination, with practically no encouragement from anybody except the historian in Ottawa. Very, very difficult for you, incredibly time-consuming, but you have done this, and you've got these records now. And I'm so glad that you have done this, because otherwise, where do the young historians like Martin Milner go in future? They go to the reports of proceedings, rather drab, dull, bare-bones things that tell where the ship went and when they got a submarine contact, bearing so many thousand yards. Rather drab and dull, without the human story behind the guys that were doing all of this. That's what they've had to compete with to get their information. I was not a little intrigued recently to get a copy of the book, U-Boats Against the RCN, or Against Canada, by Michael Hadley, a chap I've not met yet. I presume you know Hadley.
He's a colleague of mine at UVic.
At UVic, yeah. Well, naturally, you look up in the alphabetical index and see where your own name is and see what they had to say about you. And Hadley had quite a lot to say about my escapade up in Bay Chaleur, standing by to capture U-boat captains that were escaping from Bowmanville. And the only place that Hadley had to go to get that information was from the tape you took of me a year ago. That's fair enough. Well,
he went to Ottawa and got that from Dr. Douglas, yeah?
Yeah, sure, which is fair enough. That's what I would hope it would be used for. But he made a lot of personal value judgments of decisions that were made by Admiral Murray and myself of what we would do, how we would do it. And he would say, you know, I think this is the most naive idea of all, Hadley would bravely say, a decision that had been made in the most secret circumstances between an admiral and his officer carrying it out. And he was referring, I was telling about picking up this U-boat captain, and I knew he was a German, of course. We were expecting him, and we had him, and I was interrogating him, and I found that he had in his wallet some old $20 bills that had probably been issued when King George V came to the throne around 1910. And Hadley puts in a gratuitous little information. Pierce is probably confusing this with another issue when this happened with somebody else. Well, I'd never heard of this other issue. This was a totally secret operation and so on. That's the sort of value judgment made by historians. I think they could leave that out, either that or come and talk to the guy who said it and get the real story, but not take something coldly off of a line of one's interview with you and say that this is a pretty naive idea or he's confusing it with somebody else. Now,
excuse me, I remember he said that boarding party probably wouldn't have worked.
Yeah.
Well, with respect to Hadley, perhaps you know more about boarding parties than he does.
Then there is that problem, yeah.
I'll leave that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I look forward to meet him in the historical conference. Yeah. I bear him no grudge on this,
no.
But he called it as he saw it, so I look forward to meeting him. Give him my regards when you see him in Victoria and tell him I look forward to meeting him. Well, my point in saying all of that is that the young historians have to go to the record. The records are scarce. They're sparse. We're not very good at that. Once again, Hal, may I congratulate you on just really having the tenacity to come time after time and get people like ourselves to talk, because here you get the story of the man himself, and naturally, as you mentioned before, none of us want to put all the warts to be shown at once, but I think on the whole you found when you talk to people, the Ralph Hennessys and the Bob Wellens and the others and myself, you don't find that we're particularly trying to protect any position that we have. We made mistakes, sure, of course we did, and we were young and keen and eager and doing our stuff. And
you've just raised an interesting point to me. Every admiral I've met below, and every chief and petty officer, nothing to hide.
If they
made a balls up, spelled B-A-L-Z-U-P, they admitted, yeah. Mm. I think you need the spoken word as well as the written word.
Yeah, sure.
I think that you... Something else just occurred to me. Janet's just been in to call us to lunch, but maybe we can go on to this. Unification was a terrible time for the Royal Canadian Navy, and I'll just bring you into the picture by telling you what Jack Pickford said to me. Jack Pickford said to me, "You know, Hal, you did a terrible thing to us." He said, "All my life I used to tell my captain what I thought, my messmates what I thought, and my chiefs what I thought. And I found myself around unification, we were all discussing it, and I'd have a thought in my mind, and I'd just be about to open my mouth, and then I'd say to myself, 'Hey, Pickford, maybe you shouldn't say that here, now.' And I wouldn't say it." And he said, "I hated myself for it, because all my life I had been used to telling my captains and my messmates and my juniors what I thought." Right away he said, "Hellyer made us distrust one another." Now, we've heard stories about Bill Landymore, and we've heard, who wrote the book? Jeff Brock has become very acrimonious about it. Ralph Hennessy's given me a tape on it, and I said to Ralph on the tape, "You know, a lot of the Navy said Ralph Hennessy sold out." And Ralph said, "Yes, I know a lot of people said that about me." He said, "But this is the way I saw it," and he told me how he saw it at the time and why he stayed and jumped from Commodore to Vice Admiral. Now, about that period, talk, and you left about that period, and I don't know why.
Well, for one very good reason, at that period I had reached the end of 35 years' service, and under my rules of engagement as a naval officer in the RCN, and I was obliged to serve at His or Her Majesty's pleasure as long as I didn't commit any heinous crimes and get thrown out. I was required to stay for a period of 35 years for a full service career. And prior to 35 years service, I could not say I would like to go without having permission of the authorities at headquarters. But however, with the fulfillment of 35 years service, I could say when I wanted to go. Well, the 35 years of service hit me when I was down in Washington as the chairman of the defense liaison staff down there. A fascinating job. I had that. I got an extension of 1 year. I was only 53 years plus of age, but I had completed 35 years service. And I could see all this acrimonious argument going on about unification, and I had no desire to spoil 35 years wonderful, happy service in the Navy, in the Royal Canadian Navy, by flogging on for another 18 months to fill in time with this terrible business that was happening in Ottawa. Now, it had another aspect to it as well. As chairman of the defense liaison staff in Washington, I was member of the Military Committee of NATO, and three times a year we used to go to Europe. And we would go to Europe with the minister and the chief of defense staff. That was Mr. Hellyer and Frank Miller. So I had an opportunity to get to know Mr. Hellyer very well. We'd go over and back together in the service aircraft, and see each other and discuss things. And he came down, Mr. Heller came down to Washington toward the end of my time, and I had a very happy, very close relationship with the minister. He was 10 years younger than I was, but he was naturally my civilian head, and I treated him with the respect I felt the minister was due. And when it came to his proposals, you may remember they came out in a white paper, and integration was spelled out, but unification was not, except that the few words to say that there may be a desire welling up from the junior ranks that in 4 or 5 years' time it might be appropriate to have all three services unified. And that seemed fairly innocuous. If we could show it to be otherwise, perhaps this wouldn't happen. You and I know what happened, for instance, when Jeff Brock thought otherwise and expressed it. He was out on his ear. And the first thing, the whole situation with officers of Navy, Army, and Air Force began to collapse in Ottawa. We lost 17 out of 19 admirals, generals, air marshals in a short period around that 1966 time. Mm-hmm. 17 out of 19. And one could understand people like Bill Landymore. He did what he had to do, and he's our hero and always will be for doing what he had to do. But Bill said somebody's got to tell the country what the minister is doing mm-hmm. to the Navy by carrying out this unification. And he was, of course, fired, but fired with the love and respect of all of us because of what he did and the way he did it.
Now, excuse me, the way he did it, he also told his officers that they were not to resign, that they were to stay.
That's right. Yeah. Now, the other, I say quite unequivocally, Mr. Heller was a strong, powerful man, a leader, and I think if he hadn't taken this other one by the horns, this unification thing by the horns, and dogged it through immediately instead of waiting 4 or 5 years, I don't think it ever would have happened, and I don't think we would have had all the agony that we did have if he'd taken an easier attitude on it. He had a lot of good ideas. I spent many hours with him down in Washington and in Ottawa. He sent for me to come up and continue discussions on ways that I could give him, that he could do what he wanted to do, have a unified service, but not destroy the Navy and the Army and the Air Force. He could have the Royal Canadian Armed Forces, which would be unfortunate in a way because it would be RCAF. He could call us the Royal Canadian Defense Forces. This is what I suggested to him. But leave us with the elements of the Royal Canadian Defense Forces to be the Royal Canadian Navy, the Royal Canadian Air Force, and the Canadian Army. I'll tell you a funny thing here. Do you know why the Army's not royal?
Because the regiments are royal individually, I guess.
Do you know why they're royal individually?
No.
Ever since the British Army cut off the heads of King Charles, way back in somewhere like 1649, the Army has never been royal. Units of the Army, yes. The Army as a whole, no. It was the Army that cut his head off.
Because they're not loyal.
Yeah. Now, guess what would have happened after unification? Guess what did happen? We did not have a Royal Canadian Navy anymore. We did not have a Royal Canadian Air Force any longer. But we did have a Royal Canadian Signal Corps, Royal Canadian Engineers, yeah. Royal Canadian Remies, and all the others. Yeah. The Army stayed royal, and the Air Force and the Army lost it. That's an ironic little point. That startles people when I tell them. But there's a historical fact in that. But there were an awful lot of... Mr. Heller, let's give him credit for the idea. When he came in, he looked at the budget. And he looked at the expenses, he looked at care and maintenance and salaries, which was on an increase going up because of inflation. He looked at the expenditure for equipment, which was coming down because the budget was flat. And we were arriving at a stage in a year or so where the point of no return. And he tried to alter that position to have more money for equipment by cutting down on personnel, unifying the service, etc. It didn't work. It was a terrible failure, which we've been stuck with for all these 20-plus years. So the other thing I want to say, the sad part was that in 1966-67, when unification was forced through and I think a pretty unwilling Liberal government under Mr. Pearson had no real heart for it, but since Mr. Heller did, it was made law, and we've had it ever since. The sad part there was
that those who had not been fired and those who had not been discharged on what we call the Rinso list, you may remember that some very, very fine commanders and captains in our Royal Canadian Navy were prematurely discharged 10 years ahead of their time because the number of personnel had to be cut down. Perfectly true. You want to save money, you cut out people. Of course, if you cut out people, then you've got to cut your commitments. But people were cut and money was saved, and their careers of these fine officers, for the most part, were sacrificed for this idea.
This broke the heart of a lot of them.
Broke the heart of a lot of them, and there were a lot that wouldn't dream of serving anyway under the new circumstances, and they went. And the people who were left, there were two varieties. Those who were with Mr. Hellyer, and those who weren't. Now, this was a decision that each individual made about his friends. Did so-and-so stay because? Well, sure he stayed because of Mr. He got promoted. And we all had very strong personal convictions about individuals, whether they stayed because they were on Hellyer's team and were going to get promoted, or they, for whatever reason it might be. Somebody had to stay and mind the shop, and you and I know the people who did stay. No matter how much you chop off the heads of all the senior people, 17 out of 19, you've got to promote some more from underneath to take the places, to do the jobs. And, of course, the general public would generally say, these are Hellyer guys. Well, in some cases this was true. In the majority of cases that was not true. This was desperately unfair to the officer corps of the Canadian Forces, and we've been stuck with that one ever since. That's sad.
Well, I can't think. I don't like ending on a sad note, but we're going to have lunch with your wife, and so we won't be sad for more than 30 seconds. So I think we've covered today very fruitfully things that hadn't been covered before, and I think Dr. Douglas will appreciate getting this tape from you as much as he appreciated the others.
Fine. The fact that we're now going to adjourn and have lunch with my wife perhaps brings to mind that there's another story to be told about this Navy of ours, and that is the girls who served with us in our naval careers and who run the course and have not had the promotion and the other things that have been sometimes
Well, we've met them all this week, and the women we met this week that were girlfriends 45 years ago are wives now and still with us, and that's a very happy thing for Alma and me, and you and Janet, and Dan and Margot Hannington, and Junior and and on it goes. We're a happy breed.
Happy breed, and sometime somebody should take on the study of these wonderful girls who were brave enough to marry us young officers.
Thank you, Debbie.